Why are police photographing our license plate?
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Hello, this is The Reasonable Voice, Blog Talk Radio, and we come to you to connect politics and finance, humanity and world peace, and the arts in a way that encourages all to think for themselves, so the best political and life choices are made by all. With artistic overtones, The Reasonable Voice is an advocate for a peaceful and prosperous world filled with creativity and political unity. Hello, it's Marcello Rolando, and my guest this morning is the president of the Rutherford Institute, John Whitehead. Good morning, John. How are you?
Hey, good morning. Thank you.
All right. Well, you know, I've heard I've heard so much about you, and of course, most of it good, and I've read a great deal about you. I get your newsletter, etc. But I think I want to start right off with how come you get all these people screaming about you from both sides?
Because I take cases of anybody. I'm a, for example, a free speech purist. I have defended what I would consider to be despicable people, but I don't agree with them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not like a lot of groups. I don't hedge it on fundraising. I offend donors, my best donors, by the way, who we're supported by small donations. We don't we're not connected to any large foundations or anything like that. $25 gifts. Some of my best donors say, "Well, you did it again. I don't agree with you, but you do good work."
Yeah.
So, I've defended every stripe of person you can imagine. I actually helped Margie Phelps of the Westboro Baptist Church prepare her case for her father's church. You know, they're the group that stands across from funerals,
yes,
of American soldiers, and says that the reason they soldiers are dying is because America approves of gays. And
I
prepared her for Supreme Court. She won her case, and the first brief the Supreme Court cited was our brief. I'm not sure I wanted to be known for that, but she actually criticized me heavily for my views on gays. In fact, I don't want to seem politically incorrect, but she told me after I actually helped her prepare her case, she said, "John, bag lovers like you need to take it up the butt." And I looked at her and said, "Thanks for the advice, Margie."
Yes, gee. Well, you know, so much for a gift horse in the mouth and all that.
Well, what people assume is that, well, you're defending that person, you must agree with them. No. I agree with their right.
Uh-huh.
If you're peacefully on a sidewalk with a sign, no matter if it's not promoting violence,
yes,
you got me on your side.
Well, that sort of is a segue into the homeless panhandlers on the downtown mall in Charlottesville.
Yeah. I'm a big advocate for protecting the homeless, giving them a ride. You know, cause there's, you know, it's tough making it. I've helped a lot of homeless people over the years. As long as they're peaceful, you know, and they're out there with anybody else moving along, they'd have to be doing something pretty egregious for me not to want to defend them.
So, I understand. So we're on the front line.
Somebody's willing to get out there in the cold. I mean, I've actually had homeless people come to my office, and, well, there is a homeless camp here. I can't say where it's at because they don't want people to know, but I actually went out and spent a day with them, and
uh-huh,
a lot of homeless people out there, and what shocked me, and it almost brings tear to your eyes, there was a guy with a woman in a wheelchair and a tent out there laying on the ground.
Oh, God.
In November, and I thought, oh, my God, what are we doing in this country? You know, and it's that, you know, that kind of person, I mean, they may have problems, sure, but if you've got a little extra money, I try to do this. If I see somebody and I think they're hungry, if I've got some money in my billfold, I hand it to them.
I'm sorry, did we lose you?
No, I'm here.
Oh, okay. Oh, you said you handed to them. I didn't
oh,
quite...
Oh, sure. I don't have any problem with that.
Yeah.
I got jumped by one of the mall ambassadors one day for doing that, and I told him, hey, you're an irritating person. I'm going to go give him another buck.
Well, you know, there are enormous issues before us, and I know, as I told Nisha, your wife, when we chatted about this interview, I said I called because I keep hearing people say I'm not a crazy liberal, but I certainly am left of center, and I certainly believe in all the things you know that we're talking about this morning: free speech, religious freedom. I don't think religious freedom means you can impose on people who don't have a religion, or you know, or impose your religion on their religion or whatever. But I believe everybody has a right to believe or not to believe what they wish, as long as you know it's theirs and that's it, and they have free speech. And I certainly don't agree with this new thing in New York and other communities of search and seizure of Arizona, wherever, you look different, and therefore we can just assume you've done something wrong and stop you and frisk you and ask you questions and whatever. I'm not opposed to any of that, but I also don't think government should be so small it fits in a bathtub. So where do you and I meet in the crossroads of life here? I'm just curious.
I don't know. Everything you said, I would agree with.
Yeah. See, that was it.
When people, a lot of right wing groups that accuse me of being an extreme left winger, they won't post my blogs. But you know, that's okay. I'm gonna, again, Misha and I talk all the time. I don't want to be like other organizations out there that are worried they're gonna lose a few bucks because they support an issue. Now,
yes.
So I don't disagree with any of that. I mean, I have opposed New York stopping and frisking people because, well, one thing that really upsets me about a lot of that, and again, there's been a good court ruling on that right now. But,
yes.
Restricting that, but 80% of the people stopped were people with brown skin. I mean, so that's racism.
Exactly.
I don't like that. Arizona, I mean, geez, I've attacked the way they treat people, their stop, all the things. Arizona is a state that really bothers me, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's Arizona worries me for a number of reasons. But I mean, but that's, you're saying to me almost exactly what I've said to people who've been saying these things. Why would you want to talk to him? He's this, you know, right wing, blah, blah, blah. And I would keep saying, well, you know, when I read his stuff, I don't get that feeling. And besides, I agree with him. So I thought, well, finally, I'm just going to try and get him on the phone and let's find out. What is something happening next Monday we want to tell people about?
Next Monday. This coming Monday?
I thought I got a note from your office to talk about next Monday, but that's all right. That could be anything. Let me ask you, when we talk about government, to get back to that, since I am curious if it's a fine point or too fine a point, but when I look at NSA spying and drones flying over the city, New York in particular, because I'm from there, but in any city in America, or maybe other places as well. But when I look at NSA spying and drones, I'm really ready to ask the government, what the heck do they think they're doing? But I also think, I also wonder about the people who have sort of invaded government. Not that government's off the hook, we're all responsible for what we do, but invaded government with money because they make money from making things like drones.
Yeah, as I argue in my new book, A Government of Wolves, we live in a corporate police state. Everything's run by money. Sure.
Yes.
The wars are run by money. The drone industry is going to be a $30 billion a year industry starting in 2015.
Wow.
I wrote the ordinance that was passed here.
First
one in the world. I had people from France, Sweden, all the country. In fact, soon, Sweden. There's a TV station in Sweden that's doing an hour and a half interview with me on all the issues surrounding my new book. And they were surprised. I mean, I remember a guy from Great Britain, from The Guardian, who called me and he said, we don't want drones over here. And I said, buddy, you're going to have drones.
Yes.
So what you need to do is what we've done in our town, the ordinance I wrote, is get some civil liberties protection, because President Obama signed that law into effect with no protections whatsoever.
Yes.
But, you know, that's driven by lobbyists.
Yes.
There's a lot
yes.
of money to be made, as we saw with the recent Amazon's been delivering books that way. Again, I'm not anti-drone. I think, and I keep telling people this, drones can be used for a lot of good things.
Exactly.
What we have to be careful about is how the government will use them. Do we really want drones with scanning devices so they can see through the walls of your home? Do we really want them with rubber bullets, tasers, sound cannons? Is that what we want? So that's why the legislation that I drafted said the government should not be using anti-personnel weapons, because we're going to end up in a war zone in this country and people are going to get hurt.
Yes.
The other thing about drones too is I was talking to a professor who actually is teaching a drone class at one university. He says what bothered him, we talk, he says, is that they tend to fall down occasionally.
Uh-huh.
And he says the thing he's worried about is over New York or over some city, a couple of them are going to go down and some people will get hurt. So I think we're rushing ahead with something that the corporations want really badly.
Yes.
They're going to make a lot of dough off of it, yeah.
I know what you're talking about when you speak of your ordinance in our town, but since this is Blog Talk Radio going out to the world, tell us, you're talking about Charlottesville, and how did you go about that? Were you asked?
Well, I wasn't asked. I talked to a few people in the city council, good people like Dave Norris.
Yes.
And he seemed very, very interested. So.
No, Dave, yes.
Dave and a few others, the mayor, have been reading my commentaries. I've been writing on drones for several years saying we have to be concerned here. We just can't rush ahead with this thing.
Yes.
And I followed the idea. I said, hey, I'm going to write an ordinance. And so I sent it over, and the response is so positive, I thought, well, this is good. So we got 3 votes, got it passed. It was the first what you would call a legislation actually providing civil liberties protections for drones. Like I said, I had people from all over the world. I mean, I was doing interviews, and what was amazing was how the international community was saying, are Americans crazy?
Yes.
And I said, no. But our economy often is driven by corporate interests that are there for money, and they're not there for protecting civil liberties.
Exactly. Exactly. And there we agree absolutely. No question. So it is over the skies of Charlottesville that you helped to protect us from drones, and the city council went along with it.
The city of Seattle now has passed a very similar. I sent it to all 50 states into Congress.
Fantastic. Fantastic.
And 3 or 4 cities, primarily Seattle, has picked up on it, which
yes.
is good. I mean, so we've influenced actually other cities and governmental bodies.
Which is proof again that one person or organization can indeed make a difference. What tell us a little about the book Government of Wolves.
Yeah, the book's called A Government of Wolves, The Emerging American Police State. American Police State.
Yes.
It's showing all the things we're seeing from the drones, the stop and frisk. I mean, you'd have to read the book because it's detailed. But
yeah.
I had one radio interviewer said, hey, I want to call you a conspiratorialist, but you have 30 pages of footnotes. Footnoted. All the rectal and anal searches going on in cities across the country, which are pretty egregious.
Oh, my goodness.
All the things we're seeing. People, again, and what I do is I focus on, precede each section of the book with a science fiction film.
Uh-huh.
I looked at Minority Report, studied it, and Minority Report, the movie with Tom Cruise, by the way.
Oh, yes.
Set in the year 2054. All the technology in that film is already available for
okay.
use. And we're 40 years ahead of the curve.
Mm.
What people have to understand is we're moving very, very rapidly in mm-hmm. terms of technology. And if we don't curtail a lot of it, I mean, we see it with the NSA.
Sure.
I've worked with NSA agents. They're all over my town, by the way. I was eating dinner one night in Charlottesville, and I had a younger fellow come over to my table, and he said, I'm reading your book. And I said, thanks. I shook his hand. I said, I'll sign it. He said, yeah, I'll bring it by sometime. I said, who do you work for? He said, the National Security Agency. I said, that's surprising. This shows you there are good things. He said, I'm a constitutionalist.
We yes.
have a group of people in the NSA called the constitutionalists. We don't like what the NSA is doing, all the snooping, reading emails, phone calls,
yes.
downloading all messages, and we want to stop it. And I said, great going, dude.
That is fabulous. That is so fabulous. What, you know, when I first read about you defending and the privacy at home, I first thought you meant internets, but you said something, the internet, and maybe you do, but you also said something about a moment ago about drones being able to look through walls and
Yeah, the drones they use overseas in the wars have a lot of them have scanners. scanning devices, they can actually hover over a building and see your image. If you've been through the TSA scanners,
yes,
it's those images. They can actually see you moving around in your home. So, again, that violates the Fourth Amendment. What the Fourth Amendment says, and people should read it, it says we are to be secure, and that word's key in our homes, persons, papers, and effects.
Yes.
And you can't be secure if the government's scanning you and watching you.
Absolutely. Listen, let's take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk about something that a little more down to earth, not trying to be funny, but Johnny Jones and the Southeastern Middle School. But we'll be right back. Everyone, stay with us. This is Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice, and my guest today is John Whitehead, who is the president of the Rutherford Institute. We'll be right back. Don't go away.
One black man sits in an Oval Office seat and America treats it like it's the usual affair. Fair because one woman refused to give up her seat. A game of racial musical chairs somewhere between Barack Obama and Rosa Parks. America became the beautiful, a walk in the wake up and smell the roses in the park. But we are not that far from fire hoses and barks of dogs from turning them loose in the streets. Police burning up proof. In other cases, conveniently turning up proof. Attorneys become sleuths. Work product that firms can produce. Holes in stories leaves us discerning what's truth. Holes in stories, buildings, Birmingham bombing, burning the roof. The roof, the roof is on fire with burning crosses, white sheets, white lies, courtroom ties, attire, justice unbalanced like a sheet of your returns and your losses, mistakes not fully erased. Ghostface killers, post-racial thriller, Michael Jackson, light a black in the White House, two terms in office, doesn't just offset. Black people get set off, go off and set it off, get upset because police and policy politicians are playing a supreme being when they're just a Supreme Court justice. If the government was really an omnipotent ombudsman, then how come we ain't seen no justice?
Welcome back to The Reasonable Voice, Blog Talk Radio. My guest today is John Whitehead, the president of the Rutherford Institute. He's a constitutional attorney and an advocate for human rights, civil liberties. And so, John, welcome back. When we signed off, I brought up a case I know you've been involved in with Johnny Jones, a Southeastern middle school student who everything. His parents were harassed about all because of what? Tell us.
Yeah, he's a 10-year-old boy in Pennsylvania. He went up to the teacher's desk and asked for a pencil.
Mm-hmm.
His pencil lead had broken. On the way back to his seat, a little boy who was sitting in front of him picked up his notebook folder and pointed at him and with his lips silent went bang,
mm-hmm.
pretending he had a gun.
Mm-hmm.
So Johnny Jones took his pencil and made it look like a bow and arrow and shot it back.
Gotcha.
He was suspended from school for violating a zero tolerance policy against weapons. And I've written a letter. We're waiting for a response. We'll probably have to, but we may have to file a lawsuit. But we're asking that his record be expunged and that he be put back in school. The problem with these cases, and they're kind of crazy, is that this goes on. It's a permanent record. If it
yes.
only expunged, a lot of these kids, it goes on as a weapons violation. If you read the school's weapons, zero tolerance weapons policy, it's talking about nunchucks, swords, rifles. There's nothing about an imaginary pencil uses a bow and arrow. It's pretty strange, but we've been handling these cases. We've done hundreds of them. If you go to our website at Rutherford.org, you can see all the cases. We had a young African-American kid, and his parents charged racism. It may have been, but he threatened to shoot a girl across the room with a Spitwad. He's a fourth grader. He didn't do it. He was removed from school, put in a room isolated by himself. The principal recommended psychological evaluation. That night, his parents were getting ready to go to bed. They heard a knock on the door. The father walks down the stairs, kind of groggily, opens the door, and there stands two policemen. And he says, "What's up?" And the first cop said, "We're here to investigate the shooting incident." They actually turned it over to the police.
Oh, my God.
Another, again, a permanent record. We got his records expunged.
Good. Excellent.
That's crazy.
I think we're all, most of us certainly are against gun violence, but I don't understand why the schools are, I mean, zero tolerance should have some very specific, I don't even want to say boundaries, I want to say definition, so that it is about real guns and real...
Well, you know, that's what I recommend to schools. I talked to them, I said, listen, we're dealing with, let's talk about real guns. Let's not punish the kids for his imagination.
Yes.
Again, we've had hundreds of cases like this. I mean, we've had cases where kids go on a hunting trip with several of these with their father, and he leaves a Swiss Army knife in his car.
Oh, yes, yes.
Now, the police do they walk with dogs through there, and they sniff cars and actually search them, which I'm really concerned about, by the way.
Uh-huh.
They find the Swiss Army knife, kid is taken out of school, that goes on his record. We've had kids one kid who wanted to get in the Naval Academy. After that happened, he couldn't get in the Naval Academy. So, the other thing is, today, electronic record, it's very difficult. Once this goes up, you know, on a website or a school website, the NSA downloads all that, by the way. It automatically goes into a file. I actually had a long-term 20-year veteran of NSA visit me, who, again, is reading my book, Government Wolves. He said, John, they're doing a trillion bits of information every month. Everything, he said, the computer is so strong, it sucks everything up, creates a permanent file. They have it forever. So what's going to happen in the future? We're going to have some really bright kids that want to go on to be a judge. They're going to be in some kind of committee hearing. And bingo, up pops that weapons violation.
Yes.
And what was it? His finger?
Of his finger, a toy.
It's insane, yes.
His imagination.
Imagination, yeah. They punish kids for imagination. You know, when I was a kid, I wasn't removed from the schoolroom, but I loved going spitwise at teachers even. they would just go back and grab me by the hair and say, stop it, stupid.
Yeah.
Okay.
So much has changed, and certainly there is no wisdom in oversimplifying it. But when removing, I feel removing recess, removing the arts from school, removing ways that kids could release and express their creativity and imagination outside of the classroom.
Oh,
you
yeah.
know, I think that has a lot to do with. What is evidently affecting our psyche as a nation, and yet at the same time we have to fight for the personal liberties of people. It's a tough balance.
I've had people say, how can 50 people in Milwaukee stand and watch as someone getting a rectal exam on the sidewalk? I'm African American.
Yes.
Well, two reasons. One, civics is poorly taught in the schools. I mean, I have yet, and I've worked with hundreds of law students over the year who come into our program at the Rutherford Institute. My question I ask them, one of the first questions, can you give me the five freedoms of the First Amendment? Almost 30 years, I haven't had one student who can do it.
Yes.
Give me all five freedoms. The other thing is this pounding down on kids now for slight mistakes out of school, it's making them very nervous to resist authority. And again, my hero is Martin Luther King.
Yes.
Martin Luther King probably in the public school today would be in a lot of problems because he would resist authority. So I think again, as I argue in my new book, we're creating a very compliant citizen. He's going to stand around and watch this stuff happen. We can't allow this because we're already moving into a police state, and I think that's all, again, in my book. I document that.
Yes.
We have to be very, very careful that we're not creating citizens who just watch it, then go back to the mall and shop.
Yes.
And, but I think that's what we're doing. I mean, let me give you another example. Charlottesville, Virginia, my own home, I spoke to the Bar Association a couple years ago.
Yes.
I was speaking on my cases. In the middle of my speech, I stopped and I said, can any lawyer in this room, these are the best in the area, in my county, give me the five freedoms of the First Amendment?
Wow.
One guy raised his hand, and when I started to point to him, he put his hand up. And I said, I think I proved my point, right?
Yeah.
So the head of the Bar Association, after I spoke, got up and said, I think we need a course on the Bill of Rights.
Yes. You know, because we're constantly, people are constantly talking about the bill, defending the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, and then I hear them misquote both. There's some politician, I won't embarrass him by saying his name, but he's constantly talking about the Constitution, and what he quotes is the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag.
Oh, yeah. Amazing.
And every time I hear him do it, and he's done it more than once, I go...
When George Bush was running for office the first time, George W.,
yes.
I saw him in a press conference, and somebody asked him about the Constitution. His response was, oh, I'm not a lawyer. I don't know much about that.
I know.
When I saw that, I said, how in the world can anybody vote for someone like that? He's got to take an oath to defend it.
Yes.
The man doesn't even know what in the poop's in it.
Well, yeah, sometime later, the reporters caught him on the sidewalk in GW. They asked him about the, I remember this, because I turned to my wife and I said, doesn't he know he's in charge of that? But it was something about the war or whatever. And he says, oh, I just leave that up to the generals. I don't get involved in that.
And he's the
commander-in-chief. Well, all right, I'm not going to bash Bush. Heaven knows I do it enough, but there's enough blame to go around.
I'm not happy with any president. I'm not happy with the president we have now.
Uh-huh.
His Tuesday kill meetings where he decides who's going to kill with a drone.
Yes.
All that circumvents the Constitution. His attorney general has actually argued against Miranda warnings.
Yes, yes.
Holder, I mean, I just don't understand. I mean, Americans should be screaming about that.
I know, and I think the reason they don't, as you say, they've been conditioned out of civil knowledge, first of all, the civics and civil in intercourse. Because I remember in school being taught what they called government. And it was civics and, you know, the three branches of government and what they were supposed to be doing. But as I got older, not that everything changed, but my feeling in reading history is that, you know, FDR came in, and first of all, he had longer than any other president, and did things that we don't like the Japanese in the prison camps or trying to stack the Supreme Court. But he did create a foundation for Americans helping Americans get through it, and the government in particular. So our taxes, our taxes were going for something other than making war. When I hear people argue against social programs, I go, well, then what do you want our taxes used for? Because we're building what are we doing with them if it's not coming back to society to help? But I do believe, is the point I'm trying to get at, to see what you think about this. I do believe after the war, the World War II, and FDR's death, suddenly corporations discovered there was big money in this war thing. And the whole Marshall Plan, which had great intentions, had coattails to ride on, and those who rode on those coattails were corporations going out under the guise of helping Europe recover, and of course Japan, obviously, and instead made business deals,
that's what Eisenhower warned against in his famous speech, the military-industrial complex. He saw it. Now, remember, he was a five-star general. He saw it, and he was concerned.
Yes.
So he said, they're making money. They're going to destroy democracy, and they're going to totally undermine the economy. He's absolutely correct. Yeah, that's why I don't support war. No.
Yes.
A national defense, yeah, but going into somebody else's country for oil, no.
No, exactly. And what about this fast-tracking? Have you heard about that with President Obama fast-tracking the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is this whole international conglomeration to take control of trade, including, what is it, Nestle Tea trying to... claim their water, or I'm using the wrong legal term. Help me out, attorney. But they're trying to not patent it, but take control of it so that only they can have this water or whatever.
Oh, yeah, I think they will. See, the thing that people have to understand is, they were shocked. I wrote on this a couple months ago. America is promoting a global empire. The
yes.
NSA, for example, has a program called Echelon. They have bases all over the world.
Yes.
There's nowhere you can go. I've had people tell me, well, I'm going to go to Bolivia and get off the grid. But what I've been told by NSA people, they said, if you use a toaster, any kind of electric, if you use a cell phone, you're dead. You can't get off the grid.
So, yes.
Yeah, and it's that's what we're facing, a global, in my opinion, police state. If you see how the police look in Great Britain and other areas of the world,
yes,
all the police look very similar now. So we're moving to something I think is very, very dangerous. And so that's why I'm I'm sounding the alarm. In fact, I had one guy said, you sound like an alarmist. So I said, can I quote James Madison to you?
Yeah.
He said, take alarm at the first experiment with liberties. Well, the first experiment's been a long way off, but I'm concerned, I think that I'm concerned with China's influence over our country. China's not a friendly place.
No.
It's tough buying a product today. It didn't come from China. And I go, where in the heck did that come from? So I think we have a lot of reason to be concerned about the future of the country, the future of the world. But you're right. War is a huge money-making business.
So what, John, I mean, I know you're out there fighting the good fight, but what can we do? You know, we know, some of us know what the problems are. They're getting bigger. They are like the boiling the frog in the pot. It's so subtle sometimes that not everyone notices. They're too glued to TV and listening to the regurgitation of the same news stories over and over. But what can we say to the public? What do they need to do? How can they help?
Education precedes action.
Yes.
Get educated. Like we have a Bill of Rights pamphlet. People can call our group. I give it out free. You can teach your kids at home. If they don't learn it in school, teach them at home.
Uh-huh.
Get involved in your local city council. Charlottesville, Virginia, the small community, took
yes.
the lead in the United States on passing drone legislation to protect civil liberties. Where in the heck is Congress? So you can do that. That's what Martin Luther King taught. I mean, He said, get active, get out there, and if need be, grab your picket sign. And as I argue in my book, I mean, people like Martin Luther King changed the world because they had guts. He was willing to get arrested. He said, we need resistance. We need nonviolence, of course, but get out there, get active. You can change local politics. I mean, I work with people in Washington, D.C. They say the tough thing about getting to your congressman is you have to kick out the lobbyists before you get in the door.
Mm.
How many people can actually have any contact with, much contact at all with their lobbyists? I mean, their congressman in D.C. You can't even see the president of the United States. He's a king.
Mm.
But you can actively influence your local communities. As I say, one person at a meeting with a sign is considered a weirdo. Three with that same sign is considered a movement.
Yes.
They count numbers. You can do it. Charlottesville is a great example. Three out of five people voted to protect us against drones in an invasive way.
Mm-hmm.
And I had people from all over the world contacting me saying, what in the heck happened? I mean, I had the ACLU contact me and said, what are you guys doing down there? How do you do it?
Yes.
I said, I took a pencil, I sat down, and I wrote three sentences. That was the law.
Oh, wow.
Just take the initiative. And you said about television. The average American watches 160 hours of television a month.
Yes.
I tell Americans take one-third of that time. One-third of that time and become an activist.
Yes.
Otherwise, you don't believe in America. And my great friend, Nat Hinhoff, who's a great civil liberties fighter, he's 88 and lives in New York. But he keeps asking this question, John, is this America?
Mm.
Yeah, it is. It's America if you get up off your butts and do something about it. Don't sit and complain.
Yes.
You're right. I have trouble when I'm watching television news. I can't seem to get the news. But if I go on the Internet and listen to radio, I get it.
Yes, yes.
So stop being entertained, folks. I mean, go back and read Huxley's book. That's what Huxley said. He said we wouldn't be running from Big Brother. We would be smiling at Big Brother, A Brave New World.
Yes. Yes.
So it's coming. I mean, Orwell was correct. I mean, Orwell said in his book, 1984, and I talk about it in my new book, A Government of Wolves, he said there would be no place you could go that you wouldn't be listened to. Well, the FBI said 2 months ago they can turn your cell phone on now and make it a microphone.
Okay.
They can listen to everything you're doing. They watch you where you go. And people say, well, if I'm not doing anything wrong, why should I worry? Well, people forget the government collected 17,000 pages of information and tried to use it against Martin Luther King. The FBI watched him, tracked him, everywhere. CIA tried to stop this man.
Exactly.
But he kept going. We live in that world right now. You can change the world. We live in the future, but you can change it, but you have to do it. Sitting at home and, you know, I'm 67 years old. People say, why are you still doing this? Why don't you go retire to Florida? Well, I have children and I have grandchildren. I won't see them grow up in a free country.
Well, see, that's exactly it. It is about the children and the grandchildren. If you can't get off your butt for that, yeah, because that is what it is. It's happening. And if we want, I mean, you know, in so many ways, obesity and other non-political issues, we are not leaving a world for our children and grandchildren that was as good, if that's the word, as we received. We're not passing it along as each generation has. There's been a slow undoing, and I think we've reached the point, as you say, where, you know, put the remote down and get up and pick up a sign. I have gone with the Progressive Democrats of America's organization. I've gone to Congress with them, both as a reporter and as an observer, and their whole policy, and I learned and then taught and then did on my own, and that is you knock on the door and you walk in. I mean, Congress is all over that area. It's not just one building. It's not just in the Capitol as we think of, you know, when we remember the old movies. But there are different buildings, of course, the Rayburn and et cetera. And you walk in and you talk to someone. You ask for who you want to see. And it's rare that you get a member, but you do get their top person who's covering a specific area, which may be an issue for you. But I've had I've met congressmen, and they've told me, you know, this clicking of the mouse on your computer doesn't mean much to us. But as you said, he said that, you know, three people standing in my office represents to me about 5,000 votes, and I listen. So there is the need for and room for individual advocacy, but we do have to get up off the sofa and do it.
Yeah, the thing I say is freedom is a nonpartisan issue.
Yes.
If you support someone, some politician who's destroying freedom, you don't support him in that way. I mean, if he's doing something that's wrong, and you know it's wrong against our Constitution, you oppose him. You don't have to oppose him in everything.
Yes.
But don't sit on your butt.
Yes.
I mean, when I opposed George W. Bush, I remember early on when I saw the Patriot Act come out and all these things where they were lying the government to snoop on us, I started writing columns saying the guy's destroying the Constitution.
Mm.
At that time, 9-1 against me, I remember getting emails saying, what's wrong with you? He's a hero and all this stuff.
Yeah.
About 2 years later, it was 5-5.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, it was 9-1 in my favor, and people were congratulating me. If I'd have given up 4 years earlier,
yes,
yeah, I just walked away.
Yeah, yeah. Well, John, I hate to end this conversation because this has been marvelous. We're going to have to do it again sometime soon. But thank you so very much for being on the show. Everyone, this is The Reasonable Voices Blog Talk Radio. And our guest today has been John Whitehead, the president of the Rutherford Institute, a constitutional attorney whose advocacy for human rights, civil liberties. It's not about politics, although everything is politics. It's about really recognizing what the meaning is in the Constitution, in the Declaration of Independence, in privacy acts, and preventing people like the NSA. We all have to get up and stand up and do our part. We're going to say goodbye to John Whitehead now, and thank you again, John. But then we're going to come back and have a panel discussion that can with our resident panel, Mr. Bernard Hankins and Michelle Opperman and Daniel L. Garner. This is Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice. Don't go away. And John, thank you so very much for being with us. Bye now.
Thank you.
Congressmen and senators are honored as supremacists. Black and white supremacist representatives assert themselves as supreme beings with their power as limitless, existence preeminent, like they allow us, the only ones endowed to give us this free will enterprise, freedom of the press, and freedom of religiousness. We are only independent depending on what their decision is. Every politician belongs to the religious right. Democrat, Republican, Libertarian, Independent all think they give us rights. One nation under jobs, indivisible in their sights, religious rights, civil liberties, and civil rights, like the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. Well, if they reward and give us, that means they can take it away. Men and women hold a Senate seat. Seated on the throne is God alone, all power held in their hands, the three branches of the Trinity. And they shall rule and reign forever, not to be unseated, two terms plus infinity. Their word is truth, and the word of their mouth is law. Tremble before the assembly, cower and bow to them in awe. It is written, the government shall be upon their shoulders and the power of attorney. Their names shall be wonderful, counselors, everlasting founding fathers who have the power for eternity. Princes of world peace on earth, put an end to wars and towards goodwill for men. Born to us this day in the city of Camp David, called and elected to save us from our sins. The blessed child come to reconcile all the flaws of man. his amendments meant to amend the rent. Amen. 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 Amen.
Welcome back to The Reasonable Voices. In the studio with me today, as usual, the poet laureate here we have in our group, Bernard Hankins, and the ever-gorgeous Michelle Opperman, and of course, her O.G. Rose partner, photographer and also genius, whose name is, goodness, Daniel Garner. Sorry, looking at him and I'm good. Having trouble with names today. By the way, mine is Marcello Rolando. I'm your host of The Reasonable Voice. And we just had an incredible interview with John Whitehead, who is the president of the Rutherford Institute and a constitutional attorney. Who fights the good fight for those who cannot or sometimes cannot fight for themselves or speak for themselves. It was an amazing interview, and I think one of my favorite parts of it was discovering, although I don't claim to be apolitical, he does, and he's branded by the left as an extremely conservative right-wing Republican, and he's branded by the right as some kind of fanatic communist that wants everyone to have equal opportunities. So he and I had a great time realizing that we agreed on a great many things, because what we're really after is not victory left over right or right over left, but victory for everybody. And some of the issues, some of his issues actually are the five freedoms that are the first freedoms mentioned in the U.S. Constitution. And he and I talked about this. So many people talk about the Constitution and upholding the Constitution, and yet when he's in a room with people like that, or as he's mentioned himself, in a room with constitutional attorneys, he often asks, can you name me the five first freedoms guaranteed first in the Constitution? And nobody can answer that question. So, who wants to show off and say... I didn't answer them during the interview, but I had to think, and I had to think, and I came up with four, and Daniel reminded me of the fifth. But they are freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, and then, as Daniel explained to me and reminded me, freedom to petition our government. And that started a piece of the interview with John that reminded me that now... We have those rights, technically, but so many of them are being infringed upon by NSA, which is a big concern of John's and ours, and drones and police. He feels that he's writing in his new book called, I urge everyone to pick it up, Government of Wolves. Yet he does not want government to be small enough to drown it in a bathtub. We cleared that. That a police state is going. And one of the things that really hit me with that is it reminded me of something I've been reading about and wondering and writing about. And that is this right of petition slash protest to address your grievances to your government now is limited to certain areas. So if a certain event or person or organization is about to do something, or even the president, you can't stand where the event is happening. You are given a place. Yes, they call it a public park. And that area is where you get to go stand behind the ropes, guarded by police.
Right.
And there you can protest, whether or not the person you're protesting can hear you or not. Okay, so that's what we're talking about. Everybody jump in, Bernard.
Well, you just made me think of a story that happened to me a few years ago. It didn't happen to me. But I was helping a friend on a documentary. And for the documentary, we were interviewing the Phelps family.
Yes.
It was at Westboro.
Yeah.
So this was 9/11, 10th anniversary, I believe. And the 9/11 memorial was being opened at the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had all these employees coming from the Pentagon to go to the memorial service. And then you had this one section where the Phelps family had decided to protest.
Mm-hmm.
And they were surrounded by, like, a lot of people with big guns.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember my friend who's working on a documentary made the point. He's like, isn't this amazing? We live in this country where these people are just the exact opposite of what's happening over here, but yet they're being protected by the people who they're probably also protesting against.
Yes, that's the end, and that's it. And they had to be, because it was a tentative subject, especially under those circumstances. What about you, Michelle?
Oh, goodness. There's so many things to go into here. But, when it comes to the constitutional, I think about today, and I, Daniel and I have talked a lot about this, about the Founding Fathers and how they may feel about our government today. And I think they may scratch their head and wonder if they're in the right place. You know, like, is this what we, really built? And once again, we've talked about how America is a great nation. It depends on if you say that with arrogance or with a sense of gratitude. Mm-hmm. But constitutional, I feel like we've gotten so far from, the basic origins of what the country was supposed to be built off of. And I think now, instead of it being about, like, what constitutes this, constitutional, thinking about Bernard, how he usually does think about the words, what constitutes this nation? What constitutes our vision for it? Now it's like, well, there's almost a way in which anyone's opinion about what that should look like is now kind of written into it. Now you have this, like, very garrulous type of long-winded constitution with all its amendments and all of its extra amendments and all of its, all of the addendums. And, I don't know if it's really comprehensible anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something I would say. And I think that it only fosters the idea of this government, which you can't, really, it's just this concept, this is abstract idea of what government is, and the less understandable it is, it's like it is understood and it isn't understood, but it's understood by people's own beliefs in what the government is, but then what does that really mean it is? And, it's growing larger and larger and almost just unproportional.
Right. I wonder if it's understood as much as it is assumed. I think people make assumptions about government, good, bad, and indifferent,
right.
Without really understanding. But I want to give Daniel a chance to
A few in. Things. Referring to a space as a public space is similar to kind of Orwell's Eternal and Endless War. It's like here you have public space, but the very creation of that public space is a mean to contain the public. And it actually just becomes, it's like, oh, well, you can have public expression here, but nowhere else. Well, then it's kind of in the act of saying we're giving a space for the people, you're actually creating a means of containing them. Second, a tragedy in the country is that the word constitution has now been branded as right. Or, right wing or Republican. We really have a problem in this country where certain words or terms like founding fathers, if you utter them, you're immediately associated as a conservative. It's a grave tragedy because you can't even talk about this subject without the people who hear you talking about it going, oh, well, they believe in conservative things. That really messes up our ability to have a conversation about this topic. Third, when it comes to what the Constitution means, everyone thinks they know what it means. Everyone talks about the wonders of the Constitution, and like you said, Marcello, they can't even name the first five freedoms listed in it. The Constitution has become this sort of monolithic concept that one can use to legitimize anything that they want, and consequently, it's become meaningless, and that's a major issue. Fourth, one of the reasons why it's so hard to know what the Constitution says is, to use kind of an idea from Walker Percy, if you're on a desert island and the Second Amendment fell in front of you and said the people, the right to bear arms in order to establish a well-regulated militia will not be infringed. You could look at that and say, the right to bear severed arms? Why in the world? Well, that's disgusting. What is this cannibal nation? My point is that terms are not self-evident, and what things mean is not self-evident. I think Scalia says you have to pull out the dictionary from the time when the Constitution was written in order to really get what it's saying, and you also may need to read it in the context of Federalist Papers. Mm-hmm. So I think also a problem today is that we read the context within the paradigm of our modern society and define all of the things based on what we think the words mean, which someone as the genius poet Mr. Hankins here will tell you can be dangerous. Lastly, the major debate with the Constitution, I think, goes as follows. If you wanted to divide, your I can't think of the terms in your hermeneutic structures. This is the big question when it comes to the Constitution, and I think this decides your political philosophy of freedom or not. If you were to say the right, the freedom of speech will not be infringed, there are two ways to interpret that. One, the Constitution is giving you the freedom of speech, okay? But so that's like the first interpretation. Two, it's saying that you already have the freedom of speech, that it's an innate human right, and that the Constitution is recognizing that and maybe making you realize that you have that, and then second, promising to protect that. So you understand what I'm saying? There's two ways. Either the Constitution is giving you the right, or you already have the right, and the Constitution is simply making you realize it. If you believe the first, then humans don't have rights, and it's the government that gives them the rights. And therefore, the bigger the government becomes, the more human rights people have, or the more freedoms people are getting given. If you believe the second, then freedoms and rights are something that human beings have innately, that then a constitution is going to make them realize. I think today, both sides, Republican and Democrats, are leaning more on the idea that government gives people the rights rather than make them realize it, and so we are heading more in the direction of a police state and a bigger state, because you only have the freedom to protest because we give you the freedom to protest us, and so consequently we can regulate it as we want.
Especially if we regulate the geography.
Yes, absolutely.
As well, I think that's an excellent point. I do think John Whitehead and I sort of touched on this, first of all, I want to say, and I hope I remember my point, but I wanted to say for those who go, oh my God, reading the Constitution, how could we ever understand it? I'm no authority on the Constitution, but I'll tell you what I do, which makes it palatable for me. I have a CD recording of the U.S. Constitution, and I carry it around with me in my car. I also have a CD recording of the Bible. And when it's not like I have time or even would try to sit down and read the Constitution every day or even once a week. But especially when something comes up in my life or something on the news or something in current events or whatever, I question, maybe they're not, because, you know, the people in Congress who talk about the Constitution, and they're really quoting the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. You know, I've heard that more than once, and, you know, they're holding the Constitution up, and they're quoting the Declaration of Independence. Now, I think you should, you know, they're all great documents, perhaps, but you need to know which one you're talking about. But I do listen to it, so get a hold of this. It exists. I'm sure it's still around. I've had it for some time, so I can't tell you which, but it's a CD recording of the Constitution. Okay, now what was my point, though, that I was going to say prior to that? I think what government does... Oh, this is what I was going to say. John Whitehead and I were talking about the assumption, pretty much what Daniel was saying, the assumption that my question was to him, if government is not supporting, we usually say social programs, and that covers a great many things, but if government is not funding and supporting and providing that sort of thing, and we just cut all that off, then what is government doing with the tax money we give it? I always say tax money is what we lend the government to take care of us when we need that. So if we cut out all the social programs and say, no, that's not what the government's not supposed to be in my bedroom or my hospital room or my food stamp place or whatever, what then is left? And that's not a rhetorical question. What then, Bernard, is left for the government to spend our tax money on?
Well, trying to tie a lot of this together, the first thing I think of, and as you just mentioned, I can't remember, this might be from Declaration of Independence, but the inalienable rights.
Yes.
Like, well, I was thinking about that word recently and just thinking about the word alienation. Mm-hmm. And so what Daniel was speaking to is, like, you have this inalienable rights, meaning it cannot be removed.
Yes, right.
From
that's right.
That's huge.
Because then I also think about when civil rights happened, I was like, It's not like the government can give black people, oh, you guys are now equals. Like, no, we were already equal.
That's a major point. Right,
but it's the point, though. The government is recognizing.
It's an axiomatic shift.
I think
it's
even
huge.
More, the government's job is to guarantee it, not to grant it, because it is not theirs to give, but to now recognize that this is so and to guarantee that we're going to make certain it stays so.
Well, yeah, Demita, what you were just asking, I feel like perhaps, you know, because if you have complete anarchy, it's going to be, you know, absolutely ridiculous. So it almost seems as if we should say human beings are free to do whatever. Mm. But then once that starts to, everybody else starts to infringe on other people's rights, that's when the government needs to be like, okay, we're going to be this little barrier. Mm. Like, it's almost as if the barrier is there to protect and limit, in a sense. Not limit your rights, but say you are completely free. But then when your freedom gets out of whack, we have to step in.
When your freedom interferes with someone else's freedom, that's the way it's supposed to work. That's the line we draw. You know, the old cliche, your freedom of speech doesn't mean you can stand up in the middle of a theater and scream fire.
Yeah, well, I was thinking, too, on this whole idea of the rights and whether the government gives them or not. It seems to me like, you know, the whole reason why African Americans in the United States, you know, did not have, let's say, the right to vote and the same privileges as you know, white people in the United States was because the government said you don't have it. Mm-hmm. It's not like they didn't have, you know, this is kind of just piggybacking a subtle point on what Bernard just said, but, you know, I think what is interesting is that it's almost like the government and, you know, any type of rule, any type of law, any type of protection is essentially just doing what already is, for the most part, existing. It's almost like putting words to it, which then can go, you know, both be positive because you can recognize it, but can also be negative because it can be misinterpreted, or it can be, you know, you can say the negation of a person's right, or you can say, you know, you can give a person a right. You know, you can either take away a person's right, or you can give a person a right with language, you see. But if you don't have language, it's not, you know, if nobody ever said that we had the freedom to speak in public places about whatever we chose to, you know, usually man does feel a sense of just, they're verbal creatures, and that's what makes them distinct from other animals. So they speak. So it's almost this interesting thing in which the government speaks to things that already are happening and already existing in our reality, but they take the step of, you know, putting it down on paper for the protection of people. And I can, and also there can be a sense in which there can be the fear that it will be taken away, or the fear that something bad will happen, so then they feel the need, the obligation to do that, because there is that responsibility a government has of taking care of their people. So those are just some thoughts. Daniel,
The idea of saying the freedom of, you know, freedom of speech, you're helping the people recognize that they have it, and you're also giving them a sense of security that the government's not going to take it from you. You can actually kind of get a sense of how much freedom is dying when people start worrying about what they say, because then, because you have this First Amendment to tell the people you don't have to worry about what you say because you have the freedom of speech. You don't have to worry about assembling because you have that. When people start being afraid about assembling, which stuff like the IRS scam,
when you're pepper sprayed,
right, or the unbelievably, you know, the stop and frisk absurdity, which is a sign where if you're an African American in New York and you're afraid to walk down the street, that's a sign that liberty is dead. If you're a Tea Party member and you're afraid of the IRS doing an audit on you, that's a sense of freedom being lost. Whenever the people no longer feel as if they can exercise these freedoms and they're safe, that's a danger. That's not a good sign. That's a kind of litmus test. Now, the other thing I was going to say on your question of tax money, in Saudi Arabia, the people do not pay taxes, and so consequently they don't really care what the people want, because there's no checks and balances. Taxes can have this function of the government having to care about what you say, so they can be good. On the question of what taxes would be spent on if not on the social programs, one of the best uses of taxes in government history was NASA programs, where they innovated and stimulated technology and scientific discovery. Now, whether or not government can do that better than the free market is a different question, but I do think when you see that, that's an example of real innovation and creativity.
But by and large, my question was a trick one. If the taxes are not going to such
scientific exploration, social social issues. In honesty, right now, where does the government spend most of our
money? Well, if it's not going to that, spend it on itself. Government always tends to spend money on itself.
It's making war.
Well, that's another thing. Yeah. I see perpetual war.
And you know why I ask? I mean, because people, we talk about, we hear all the time, you know, drones cost this, each bomber is this, and it's X number of dollars, a million, and we don't think about that. Well, we should think about it, again, as John Whitehead and I discussed, because those who are making those weapons are making money every time those weapons are used. They don't make them when we store them someplace peace. So,
well, before we wrap up, the last thing I wanted to say was, you know, because you hear in America a lot, we use the word liberty and we use the word freedom, and we pride ourselves on being, we're America, we're a free country, and that word is used so often that it loses its meaning, but we're very proud of it. But the thing I think we have to do is you have to really define freedom, because I have this example of, you know, if you're in a Ferrari and you're like, I want to go 200 miles an hour around this curve. So you're being wild and free and exuberant and, you know, pushing the limits, but then you wreck your car and now you're in a wheelchair. So your quote unquote freedom has just now bound you to a wheelchair. You know, you can be free and say, I want to use substances all the time. Now you're addicted. So if we have to really, like, truly define what freedom is and realize there's there is limitations to freedom, but we don't like to hear that because we think the truest freedom is without bounds completely.
And to piggyback off that, if I give you a present for free that you don't pay for, it can be hard to value it, you know, because it's free. You didn't have to earn it. So one of the challenges with freedom is to have it where it's just given to you, and to value it and to not abuse it, to be of such a such a mental disposition and character that it doesn't become valueless to you or meaningless.
Well, I think that's why it's important, though, you know, with what I was saying before about the government and what its ability to do, you know, on how it affects freedom and how we receive it or think about it. But it's important, like Daniel was just saying, about the character that it takes to have freedom. And this is why I think, like, the government is important, and it has a role in helping us understand what freedom is in for a nation. But I think it also matters about, you know, who we are as people, and the fact that we have, you know, that we are challenging ourselves to grow as individuals, because that's the only way that we can understand how to interpret what government is even doing with freedom itself, you know, and what how it is defining it and how it compares to, you know, the freedom that we've come to know through, you know, character growth and through learning and through understanding and through being receptive to the world around us, you know. So I think that, anyways, that was just a point about how character and freedom are really linked.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. We thank you for joining us in the show. The Reasonable Voices with me today in the studio are our spoken word poet, Bernard Hankins, and the dynamic philosophical duo, Michelle Upperman and Daniel Garner of O.G. Rose. We thank you for joining the show. I'm your host, Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice, hoping that you and your voice will become one of the reasonable voices heard around the world.